The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, good morning to you. It's National Pizza Day today. What's your pizza topping of choice?
Definitely mushrooms, lots of cheese, and something spicy.
Perfect.
Peppers.
Excellent. I was hoping you weren't going to say Avo, because as I said, they've snuck Avo in while we were debating pineapples. Everybody's talking about Avo, and it just tastes so yesterday.
If we're really talking about food, let's talk about the top 50 restaurants in the Middle East and North Africa, the list of which was published yesterday. Mm-hmm. Israeli restaurants feature on the list, and quite a number of them are within the top 50. The third best restaurant in the Middle East and North Africa is an Israeli restaurant called OCD. I don't know what you have to be like to go there, but nonetheless, that is what it is called. There are another six all in all, Israeli restaurants that are included in the top 50 rankings. In ninth place is a Tel Aviv restaurant called George and John. Chef restaurants in Israel have become quite a thing. And the chefs who are behind these restaurants have also become quite celebrity-like, sort of rivaling on an Israeli scale, of course. You know, the likes of Gordon Ramsay and Jamie Oliver and others who become very, very famous as chefs on TV and in their restaurants. So eating is definitely something of an art in Tel Aviv. And of course, the third best restaurant in the Middle East and North Africa is OCD. Very, very interestingly that a whole bunch of restaurants from Dubai occupy the top spots. First, second, fourth, they're kind of amazing. Four in the top six. And, you know, the restaurants in Dubai are apparently something to behold. The unfortunate thing for some people about these restaurants, the Israeli restaurants, is that in the most part, they are not kosher. And so, unfortunately, those people who do keep kashrut will not be able to eat at them. But it would be interesting to see actually which out of these six in the top 50 actually are kosher restaurants. I'll actually have a look at that and come back to you on that. But it's interesting that food is becoming very much an art. You know, we're so used to Jewish cooking, which a lot of it is about keeping you geschmack and satisfied and stodged up in a sense. And now, you know,
about the celebrity nature of the chef. It's not just about the food. It's about the whole personality behind it, which is so interesting as well.
Exactly. I mean, and, you know, a lot of these chefs open up not only restaurants, but some of them have opened up bakeries. And of course, it's all about their name. The moment you see, I don't know, Chaim Cohen, for example, is a good example, a nice Jewish name, but a celebrity chef. Mm. When you see Chaim Cohen's restaurant or Chaim Cohen outlet, people are very much drawn to it because of the name of the chef that stands behind it. In the case of OCD, also a celebrity chef in the form of Raz Rahav, also quite well known. So he is something of a name, and I guess as a result of him being included on this list, will become more of a name. Well done to these restaurants who've done so well.
Absolutely. Three Palestinian terror suspects killed in an Israeli ambush yesterday. Tell us about it.
So this was a very emotionally charged day yesterday, because not only did this ambush take place where these terror suspects were killed, but also the funerals took place yesterday, and there was a lot of emotion surrounding the funerals. There was vows of revenge taking place around the funerals, a lot of criticism about the fact that these people were killed. But what we understand is that Israeli security forces went into an area of Nablus, into Shechem, a neighborhood there, and they shot and killed three individuals. Originally, it had been reported that four people had been killed in the process. It turned out afterwards that one had managed to escape and is apparently still at large. We understand that this was a fairly well-planned, pre-prepared exercise targeting specific individuals who believed or reported to have been involved in shootings and attacks against Israelis over the past few months. We did talk We have talked in recent times about an increase in the number of attacks that we've seen over the past few months, and this is the Israeli response to those attacks. They managed to kill these three individuals. The funerals, as I say, were very, very emotionally charged. Lots of support for Hamas and lots of support for Fatah as well. Flags, thousands of people turning up at the funerals. We understand that the individuals themselves were involved with some of the more established terror organizations, the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade in particular. They vowed revenge for their members' deaths. So there was no denying on the part of the Palestinian side that these individuals had been involved in activities against Israelis. On the contrary, they were quite proud to announce that these are martyrs that have been killed as part of their opposition to Israel and to the usual mantra, opposition to the occupation, and all kinds of other criticisms that are generally launched when these kind of things are concerned. But definitely a lot of emotion and a lot of vows of revenge that, you know, there will be revenge attacks in order to respond to this particular event. So a lot of emotion yesterday, unfortunately. And it was also tied into some comments that were made by the Hezbollah leader, Hassan Nasrallah, who claims that if Israel was able to beat Hezbollah, then they would have done so long ago. They would have already attacked and done so long ago. And while it sounds like just a cheap shot in order to just to try to regain the moral high ground, or at least get a little bit of press coverage for himself, the reality is that if Israel was to try to enter into an operation against Hezbollah, which has been predicted will happen already for the longest time, there is no doubt that there will be casualties. It's not going to simply be an easy exercise. Hezbollah are very, very well armed. They've been very well practiced in their recent conflict in Syria. And it's not a simple exercise. They're very well dug in that area of southern Lebanon. And so while Israel certainly has the firepower and Israel certainly has the capability to inflict a massive damage on Hezbollah, the problem is that with everything that is done by Israel comes a camera, comes an international press broadcast. Absolutely. And so everything that gets done by the IDF these days, before buttons are pushed, before missiles are launched, before anything happens, has to be signed off by lawyers, has to be signed off by legal advisors within the IDF. And they now are part of every single consideration when battle plans are put together, when operations are outlined. The lawyers have to sign everything off because there is the concern, there is the understanding that every single action will come with some sort of a claim at the International Criminal Court, at the International Court of Justice, claims in the international press. So it's not a simple exercise anymore. Once upon a time, there was activity on the battlefield which wasn't captured on camera, which didn't have to be signed off by lawyers. These days, that is clearly not the case. And it sort of links in a way to an event that took place overnight where Israel has been accused of firing missiles in Syria, as a result of which an anti-aircraft missile was fired from Syria and it entered into Israeli airspace. Sirens were sounded in the northern part of Israel, particularly in the Wadi Ara area, Umm al-Fahm. Places like that had sirens sounding during the night. The missile itself exploded in the air in the end, so it didn't actually land in Israel. But apparently there were, according to the reports, Israeli airstrikes were carried out against Syrian targets. It's like a dance. The Syrians are involved with getting weapons and missiles and weaponry from Iran. As soon as the plane lands and the missiles and the armaments begin to move, Israel comes and launches airstrikes, apparently this time from Lebanese airspace, we understand. It just kind of is an ongoing thing that we see constantly. And it doesn't seem like there's going to be any end. There's no deterring the Syrians and the Iranians from pursuing these activities in spite of Israel's attempts to somehow try to limit it.
Yeah, it's just absolutely unbelievable how, and quite sad when I'm listening to you talk, that it is possible that because of this position and the legal side of it and the scrutiny, additional lives could be lost.
That's exactly what happens, because you know the suspicion will always fall upon Israel, because Israel has the firepower, the organized army, the huge amount of armaments, the technology. All of that, you know, represents Israel as being the aggressor, as having the advantage. It's so ironic. You know, I'm always forced to go back to days before the State of Israel and compare to where we are now. Those days, you know, Jews around the world dreamt of having a Jewish army, dreamt of having this organization and these armaments and this ability to protect Jews and to be feared in the international community because of our ability to protect ourselves almost at any price. And now that we've managed to build up that capability, now we fear the fact that we have to use it because we're under such close scrutiny and under such suspicion for every activity, every action that we take. It's very, very ironic that the wheel has turned so dramatically.
And very sad. Tell us about this outbreak of the newest variant of COVID-19 in Israel.
So this is one, we're going back to the numbers and the letters again. I wish they would give it a name.
Yeah,
why would we have to have letters and numbers?
Yeah.
Oh, my. This is currently called BA2. And I don't know what the B and the A and the 2 stand for, but I'm sure that there's somebody out there who knows this stuff and will update us. But BA2 is apparently a way more contagious variant of Omicron, okay, where we thought Omicron was like the end game, was so contagious that it was going to infect anybody and everybody, and it's you know, fairly mild, and so it's all good. Now we have BA2, which is apparently 3 times more contagious than Omicron. And by the way, the reports in Israel suggest that up to 20% of Israelis contracted Omicron over the last couple of months, which is an astonishing number. But it sort of does lend itself towards the whole herd immunity kind of thing. I mean, not that I'm really aware of whether herd immunity will contribute anything to any of this. But we are now told that more than 700 Israelis have already been diagnosed with BA2. And so whereas all restrictions have been lifted now, and the fourth vaccination program is rolling out, and even people who apparently have corona are entitled to be out in the public under particular circumstances, although in the most part, the rules suggest that if you have been diagnosed with corona, that you need to stay home at least for a limited period of time to be out of the public. But really, all kinds of restrictions. If you've come into contact with somebody, you don't have to stay at home as long as you're vaccinated. You know, all the restrictions that we saw previously, even if we thought that we might have had corona, then everybody was forced to stay home. Now, that's not the case. So all the restrictions are lifted. Some people are saying a little bit too soon because of the number of people who've been infected. Our hospitals are pretty full, more than 1,000 people who are seriously ill with corona. So this is a massive number and higher than we've had before. But reports are suggesting that the hospitals are really coping with things. There isn't too much drama around the medical facilities, that everything is kind of working okay. It's difficult for us to know what this BA2 is going to mean, though, and how infectious it's really going to be and how it's going to affect us moving forward. But apparently it's very much here and spreading itself quite well amongst Israelis at the moment. So we will be watching the space just to see where that takes us.
Yeah, and it's a real concern, because you know, if this is behaving differently, then that is something that we're going to have to keep an eye on. And in 1 minute or less, a bill is making its way through the legislative process that will limit the Prime Minister's term in office to 8 years. We spoke about this before.
We have spoken about this before, and it's something that I definitely welcome. I think that there is definitely something positive in the whole U.S. style of doing business, which says that in the case of the U.S., the president can only be in term for two periods of office, 2 4-year periods. I think that that's very, very healthy. I think that there is something which prevents someone from becoming too entrenched in their office, and the Israeli legislators have decided that there is something to be said in favor of this. And the bill already has passed its first reading in the Knesset and has passed Knesset committees. And what it means is that Prime Minister Netanyahu, who already has served a good number of years in office and certainly more than eight, will not be affected by this bill. So he could still return, because this is a bill that's not going to affect people who have already been in office. So this is only moving forward for new people. I certainly personally welcome it. I think it's very healthy for our democracy. And I think it's a little bit too little too late, but potentially could be good in the future. But certainly the way that it's moving at the moment, this could become something quite real in Israel. And it's going to be interesting to see how it potentially changes things moving forward. Because I think it's a very, very healthy change to things.
Absolutely right. It is 8 o'clock. Anthony Reich, thank you. As always, we'll catch you tomorrow morning.